Welcome back. I just want to read one paragraph in here. You know, it seems like every action step has a series of promises after it, and you can look at the promises as a reward, or you can look at the promises as benchmarks. Like, have these promises come true in your life? And if you're real honest with it, you're going to probably say yes if you've done a real good job with that particular step. If you say no, then there's probably some work that got missed. There's probably some things that that you could go back and maybe be a little bit more thorough on. So the promises are great in that, you know, they're showing us what is going to happen by doing this work, but they also show us that we might have missed something if they don't actually come true in our lives. Basically says here, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Truly, truly, these resentments, what they do is they sap the quality out of our lives. You know, you get to the end of your life and you've been mad at everybody. You've practically wasted your life. Because resentment is just corrosive. It corrodes your ability to enjoy this life. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look upon them as sick people. We've listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, and we are willing to straighten out the past if we can. And, you know, with a true perspective on our behavior, I think that, you know, as alcoholics, as spiritual people, we do want to straighten out the past. We do want to be different people. We've wanted that for a long time. We're the perfect example of a person who wants to be better but continues to make the same mistakes over and over again. That's what alcoholism is. So, you know, we've done an inventory. We've compiled this whole thing. Now it's time to share it with somebody. Now it's time to pick somebody that's going to hear this. You know, when this book was written, there was really only two groups of drunks in the Oxford group at that period of time. A third group was about to start in Cleveland, and there were some splinter groups around New Jersey. But they really expected this book to be published and to be sent out around the country, to be made available to alcoholics who are still drinking. The alcoholic will be able to read this book, and boom, they're gonna go, okay, I'm convinced, I'll do what's in here, and I'll get sober. That's not exactly what happened. They found that this book kind of needs to be taught. There were some examples of people who had been exposed to this book who were able to get sober just by reading the book and doing what it said, but that was rare. Mainly, they found that this spreads by word of mouth, this spreads by one drunk talking to another drunk, one drunk taking another drunk through the steps. You know, so they'll tell you to look for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend or whatever. In this day and age, you can't shake a stick without hitting an experienced alcoholic who understands what needs to be done, who knows that they need to keep a confidence, and will encourage you to do this. So it's not hard to find somebody anymore that can hear your fifth step, but it's very, very important to share it. Some of my experience with this step, the very first time I did a fifth step, I shared just a little bit about it earlier. I did it with my first sponsor, and at the end, he basically said, "This isn't so bad." And then he turned to me and he said something that's always stuck with me. He said, "Chris, you know, I believe that you were an alcoholic before you started drinking. And today, I believe the same thing. I do not believe anymore that I'm an alcoholic because I drank too much. I believe I drank too much because I'm an alcoholic." And those are two different things. I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. You know, it's genetic, it's psycho-spiritual, whatever it is. You know, I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. And here's, and this is what my sponsor said to me after I did my fifth step. He goes, Chris, I believe that you were an alcoholic before you started drinking. And what that means is that you're like an emotional campfire that's burnt down, and all you can see is like the red coals are smoldering. And when you started drinking alcohol, it was like throwing gasoline on that. And you flared up and you burnt everybody around you, including yourself. You know, and now what you're doing is you're making a real serious effort to work these steps of recovery, and you're taking responsibility for your life, and you're making a real attempt to get better. And you should lighten up on yourself. You know, because when here's how I was reading my inventory. You know, I resent my mother. I felt like such a scumbag, you know. And I mean, you know, I couldn't look you in the eye. I had a lack of self-esteem. I had a gigantic ego, but I had a lack of self-esteem, and I was just messed up. And so what he was saying was, my alcoholism was not my fault. Okay, yeah, I took the drink and I caused a lot of problems, but being an alcoholic was not my fault. Now, I've experienced all the problems, I'm inventorying all the problems, but now I'm taking responsibility. I'm starting to take responsibility for this stuff, and I'm going to take action to try to become a more spiritual and less problematic individual, you know. So lighten up on yourself, he said. Now that always stuck with me because it was that moment in time that I started to believe that maybe I'm not such a scumbag. Maybe now I'm at least starting to take responsibility for this stuff and moving forward. And it was a shift. Like the moment he said that after the fifth step, you know, I changed, and my perception of myself changed. Now, I've done many, many fifth steps since then, and each time it's a centering exercise. It's a taking account of the stock and trade exercise, and you know what it's doing is it's placing me right where I need to be. One of the alcoholic's main problems is an inability to accurately assess, you know, your own problem, you know, where you are in life. There's just something about alcoholism that doesn't allow you to understand how much trouble you're in. And this inventory process, you know, cuts that away and gets us down to the truth about basically about our stock and trade, you know, what's going on with us. I think once we start to become honest with what is really going on in our lives, all of a sudden, you know, we open the windows to this really dark room and the sunshine starts to come in. And it's the beginning of real serious healing. And as we move through our life, listen, we're not perfect people. And I'm grateful for that. I don't like perfect people. You ever meet somebody that's like perfect? You want to get away from them as fast as you can. I want to hang out with the maniacs, you know. You know what I'm saying? It's not necessarily about getting perfect. It's about identifying room for improvement, you know. And as I continue to practice this, the principle, the spiritual exercise of step four, the spiritual exercise of step five, what that does is it renews my perspective, and I get a more accurate perspective on what's real in my life and what I need to pay attention to and what needs to be important to me. And I need that centering because I can get way off track. I can get way off track. There's something that kind of keeps us from being able to stay on track without this exercise. So it's, you know, I've found it incredibly, incredibly beneficial. And I try to do a fifth step with a different person. I don't go back to the same sponsor every time because I like different feedback. I'll go to somebody over here. I'll go to somebody over there. I'll do a multiple fifth step. You know, I'm going after different experiences and different feedback because it's about spiritual growth. And if you keep doing the exact same thing that you did before, you know, you'll get what you got before. But sometimes it's about broadening your perspective. So that's kind of my experience with this.
So I kind of loaded the shotgun earlier, but I kind of want to pull the trigger on it because I think that in terms of looking at inventory and fifth step process and looking at, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, I think that as an alcoholic, I like to skim the surface. You know, in 60 to 64, when it talks about the actor and he says that we take, you know, most responsibility, but we think that others are more to blame. Yeah. You ever, like, write an inventory, right? And you're like, you know, yeah, I was selfish because I wanted him to change. I was trying to fix him. I was dishonest because I was delusional. I thought I was God. I thought how he should be. I was fearful that I was going to get hurt, fearful of not having control, fearful of this and fearful of that. But we miss, like, the real meat of the resentment, the real meat, the real truth. And the real truth is that, you know, I have a delusion. My delusion is that, you know, I think I know who I should be. My delusion is I think I know how you should be. My delusion is that you need to change for me to be okay and to be centered in the world. My delusion is that I minimize God. Part of there's two things that we get from the fourth and the fifth step. One, we get an eight step list, right? Because we take what's on our fourth step and we make a list. We take those people off our fourth step and we make an eight step list with it, right? We also have the nature of our amends because that's our fourth column, right? But there's another thing that we get. There's a surrender that occurs in the fourth and the fifth step that can only occur in the fourth and the fifth step. You know, step one, we surrender to booze. And step two, you know, I'm surrendering to this process and I'm saying, okay, there is a solution. Step three, I go about getting that solution. But it's step four and five when I get to see the details, the minutiae of my problem, the delusions that I carried around, the concepts that were killing me, the thought processes which were the very things that were blocking me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. So there's that surrender that occurs in the fourth and the fifth step, and truly I looked at myself, pen and paper, and I looked and I saw the truth about who I was, what Kerry really did. Because no, I don't do something schmucky and say, well, you know, I did it because I was planning on being a jerk today. I do it, I wrap it up in that spiritual make-believe, and I say, well, you know, I told her off because she needed to know where she was at, because she needed to grow spiritually, and, you know, she needed to know the truth about herself, so I decided it was me who was going to sit and tell her. Ever do that? You ever, like, rationalize being mean to somebody because they just pissed you off and you wanted to cut them down just a little bit? And you use the 12 steps in the program and accountability to justify your behavior? Ever do that? I have. You know? So part of what I'm doing in this process is I'm surrendering. I have a deeper surrender because now I have the truth about the stock in trade. I've looked at the great defects and the small defects of my character. I've begun to see that the things, the labels that I put on things, the concepts, the beliefs that I created, there's this process of going through the work and writing a four step, and it's the theater of the lie, and people have been doing it for a really long time. And it's a really great thing, you know, in the extended third column where you write out how these areas were affected, right? And I'll tell you what, there's this website, it's called Just Love Audio, and whenever I do big book workshops, I always pimp this website because it has every single kind of, like, four-step format you could possibly imagine. Like, I kind of go in there and I'm like, ooh, I'm going to do this exercise today. You know, for me, I kind of rediscover stuff that I've known or things that I've done 10, 15 years ago. So if you want to go on there and find a new way of writing a four-step, there's awesome things on there. So check it out. But there's this extended third column, and I never really understood, like, you know, I've written the Theater of the Lie inventory, I've written extended third columns, I've written all that stuff, and I kind of didn't get it for a really long time. Until I was sitting down, I was doing a fifth step, I was doing a multiple fifth step, because, like, that's also something I always do. At this point, I don't even bring inventory to one person anymore. I usually, when I have inventory, there's two or three people sitting with me. That's just me. I like to do multiple fifth steps. I find it to be incredibly useful. In fact, I do multiple 12 steps for that matter. When I got a drunk, I get three, four people. We're all going to sit down and pepper them and having to, you know, help bring them through their first step. And when I have inventory, I'll often bring in one or two of my sponsees and a handful of friends and a sponsor, and we're all sitting down and they're listening to my inventory. I mean, for me, like, sitting down one-on-one anymore is kind of boring. So I like to have that dynamic, that group dynamic, and doing a fist step. I find it to be incredibly useful. But when I was writing this extended third column, the Theater of the Lie, I was like, okay, you know, yes, Carrie's Zena, and Carrie's this, and Carrie's Miss AA, Carrie's mom, Carrie's, these are my characters on this stage, and, you know, in this 60-64, which is why my sponsor had me read that every day to see the character that I was playing to get the result that I wanted to have, because I was playing God, because I was demanding how you should behave and what I should get out of any given situation. Okay. But what I didn't realize is, you know, when the book talks about it, it says human powers failed us, right? And it says that, you know, we had to find something more than a human power. Well, let's look at the things in the third column, right? We have self-esteem, right? Isn't self-esteem the need to feel good about myself? Don't I use human powers, like, you know, I'm a female. I'm 37 years old. I look like I'm 30. I'm svelte. Right? So I use being an attractive woman as a way to feel good about myself, don't I? I use my intelligence. You know, I graduated summa. I was a high school dropout who graduated summa. You know, I use my intelligence as a way to feel good about myself. Self-esteem. I'm using things outside of me, fixed points outside of me, to make myself feel better, right? So what happens when I get old? What happens when I get fat? What happens when somebody doesn't like my brand of pretty? I'm nothing, aren't I? Because I'm using a human power to give me what I should be going to God for. My security. I need you to like me, validate me, or love me to feel safe with myself, because I can't be safe with myself unless people value me. Ambitions. I need you to give me what I want. What I want is for you to, always like me, to have money, to have approval, to have acceptance, to be successful. And if you stand in the way of the things that I want for myself, if you interfere with those, I become fearful, don't I? My personal relationships. Well, my personal relationships should always go my way, and you should always do what I want, and you should never make me feel bad about myself, right? Sex relationships, triple that. Pride. I should always look good to those around me. And you should always think good things about me. And you should never say or do anything that might make me look bad. Because what's going on with this whole thing is that there's a lack of sense of self. There's a lack of carry. There's a lack of experience that there is a God. There's a God's carry that exists independently of you. And each one of us, there is a kernel of God. It exists within each one of us that is untouched by the outside world, untouched by anything that goes on out here, and exists within us. When I'm in this place of fear, when I'm hurt, threatened, or interfered with, right, I get resentful, but I'm resentful because I'm afraid. Because fear is ruling me. Fear is like a bowl of fish hooks. If I put my hand in, I can't pull up just one. That's why fear is so powerful. It's the evil and corrosive thread, because when I'm afraid of not being loved, I'm also afraid of being rejected. Let's quickly run this down. You don't love me. What happens? Well, if I'm not loved, I'm not good enough, right? There's something wrong with me. If I'm not good enough, other people are going to see it. They're going to reject me. If people reject me, I'm going to be alone. If I'm alone, I'm worthless, because there's nobody to tell me I'm okay. If I'm not okay and I'm worthless, I'm unfixable, because I'm not going to God. I'm going to you to fix me. I'm going to you to give me all the things that I should be going to a higher power for. I'm going to human power. If there's no human power to fix me because I'm unfixable and I'm worthless and I'm alone, then I'm outside of God's grace, aren't I? Because I'm not going to God with a big G. I'm going to God with a little G. I'm going to God in human power. God in human form. So I'm outside of God's grace. What happens when I'm outside of God's grace? I drink. I die an alcoholic death. Even worse, I die a spiritual death. Fear is so powerful because they're all connected. I can't have a fear of not being loved, a fear of not being good enough, a fear of being alone without having a fear of rejection, without having a fear of worthlessness, without having a fear of death, without having a fear of dying. They're a domino effect. So we have these core fears that operate in our lives that are connected to the things in our third column that I couldn't see for the longest time. because I couldn't see how human power was replacing God's power. I talked about God and I acted as if I worshiped you. I said spiritual things, but my actions, my feet said that I relied on human power. So when we're doing this fourth and fifth step, when we're having this process and we're writing out the very pitiful and pathetic things that we think, that I think, you know, and they're not pretty. My fourth column isn't, you know, Carrie's dandy. My fourth column is usually Carrie's a pathetic, pitiful asshole who walks around and thinks the world owes her. That's what my fourth column usually looks like. I mean, I'm not trying to be snarky, but that's the truth. Is I think everybody should just give me a fucking cookie and pat me on the head. But that's not the world. That's an unrealistic expectation. So part of this process is to wake up and become aware of these thought processes that own me. Because if I'm not aware of them, I don't know what I'm offering to God. I don't know what I'm asking God to fix. I don't know what I'm bringing out into the world. I'm bringing these bags full of garbage everywhere that I go, and they reek and they smell and they dribble nasty water everywhere. But I don't know the contents of my garbage bags, and I don't know why people are repelled by them. Because I'm not looking at what I'm carrying with me. I'm carrying this broken spirit everywhere I go, and I wonder why there's discord, why there's disharmony, why there's lack of understanding, because I'm expecting you to speak my language rather than learning yours. I'm making demands on the universe, saying the universe should change to make it comfortable for me, rather than me trying to understand the rules of the universe and change my perspectives to work more fluently within your world. And it's very simple. There's actually a movie called Stuart Saves His Family. Have you ever see it? He says that there's this one line, it bowled me over. He said that I wanted to carpet the world instead of wearing slippers. I want to change the entire world so I'm comfortable, rather than modify something very simple as wear a pair of slippers and change my point of view so that I can be more successful and effective in my relationships and in my world. How awesome is that? So this process is about a truth-seeking process. It's about seeing the real truth about who I am. I'm not supposed to finish a fourth and a fifth step. There's two things that happen. I finish the fourth step, and I really am supposed to feel like a piece of shit. Because if I think that what I do is valuable, I'm never going to change it. If I think there's value in what I'm doing, value in the way that I believe, value in my actions and my conduct, if I think that there's something I can be getting out of it, there's never going to be a willingness to let it go. It says, I look for the broken and unsaleable goods, and I get rid of them promptly without regret. So I have to see the truth of that, and I'm supposed to not feel good about that. And the fifth step is that cleansing process where I share this stuff. You know, it is, yes, a lot about the take it to the grave and tell the things that you don't want to say and the icky, icky, icky stuff. You know, like, I'll give you a perfect example, something that I struggled with for years I didn't want to tell in a fifth step. When I was in rehab, I found out that I discovered that there was, like, this place called, like, Lord of the Flies where kids got to do whatever they wanted, which was, like, you know, group homes and stuff. Because I was, like, in rehab with a bunch of kids from, like, group homes, and I was like, wow, you mean I can get out of my, like, religious dominating family and, like, you know, totally hang out with only kids and have very little supervision? Totally cool. So I'm going to make up an abuse allegation and tell the nurses and my rehab so the DIFAS can remove me from my home. I swear to God, this was my bright idea. So I made up this abuse allegation. They investigated. And of course, my parents are wonderful people. So they were like, yeah, this isn't true. But it was something that really shamed me. Can you believe that? Like, I was that bad of a kid, or that selfish and self-centered, that I would, like, totally annihilate my parents and my family because I wanted to be able to drink without people bothering me. So I thought having Child Protective Services remove me from my parents' home would allow me to drink in the way that I wanted to drink. That's how I thought nothing of, like, you know, making up allegations against my parents to do that. That amend was a very interesting amend, by the way. But my point is I had all of this stuff. So part of it is telling the take it to the grave, the shameful things. Part of it is seeing the truth about what I really think, the truth about who I am, and not to put pretty labels and cute labels on things. I was sarcastic. I used to think it was cute. I was mean. I would say mean things to you, and I would dress it up with a smile, and I would think that I was adorable and witty. It's not witty. It's called being a bitch. You know, my job as God's child is to, one, sometimes it is to tell you the truth that's uncomfortable and say the very thing that's going to break you down. Because my job is not only to help break you down, but build you back up. And if I'm breaking you down for the pure pleasure of breaking you down, I'm being a bitch. If I'm telling you a truth that might move you closer to God and help you to let go so that you can grow, and I'm willing to provide you with a way to build you back up, then I'm being God's tool. And that's the real question, is when am I being a bitch and when am I being God's tool? When is my ego engaged in this, and when is this about me being of service to God? See, these are things that I needed to look at in inventory, because after writing the first gross inventory or handful of gross inventories of the stuff that I did was when I was drinking, I need to look at what I'm doing in sobriety. Who am I in Alcoholics Anonymous? How am I practicing these principles after 15 years? How am I practicing these principles after 20 years? Who am I really to my family? Ask my kids whether I'm a good person, and they will tell you I am. Ask my husband if I'm a good person, and he will tell you I am. Am I a good person, honey? My best friends, am I good? Ask the people closest to me. You know, don't look at what I do out in the world, because out in the world is about me putting on a show. Ask the people who see me on a daily basis, who saw me put on 3 dresses yesterday because, you know, I didn't want to look fat. You know, ask those people how I'm really doing in my life. How are these principles? And those are the people I do my fifth step with. Not my husband, if I have a resentment with him, but those are the people who hear my inventories. Those are the people who hear my 10 steps. I'm not telling people who are outside of me. I'm sharing who I am with the very people that I live with. Because those are the people who are in my life. Those are the people who need to see who Carrie really is. I need to see who I am. They need to see who I am. And the truth with a capital T of this entire process is to find that I am a child of God. There is nothing I haven't heard in inventory. There's an old saying. It says that, you know, there are 2 types of fist steps. People who have sex with animals and people who don't. I've heard the fist steps where people have had sex with animals. I am not kidding. You know, there's a guy out there who, like, you know, I don't really know. He's never heard my inventory, but for some reason he thinks that I'm a freak. So anytime he comes across a woman with some bizarre inventory, he's like, I got the girl for you. And they call me up and be like, so-and-so told me to talk to you because, you know, my dog, like, ate peanut butter out of my coochie. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what do they really think? Like, what is this person saying to them? By the way, I got this girl to hear your fist at because she has done everything. But no, I mean, that literally happened. I'm not kidding. But it is funny. But think about that for a minute. We're all God's children. There is nothing any of us haven't thought or done. I might not have done it, but I've certainly thought it. There's nothing that I'm going to hear in an inventory that I haven't heard before. What amazes me is how common these concepts, these behaviors, these ideas are amongst us. And how much we really do believe that we are the exception to the rule. How much we really do believe that it's, you know, I have that four-step, that's that special magical four-step that is the suckiest four-step and the suckiest inventory, and I am the worst alcoholic there ever was. And then we sit down, what I love, and that's part of why the multiple fifth step is a really cool thing, because what I'll do is I'll take somebody who's been sober like 10, 15 years, 20 years, I'll take somebody who's just been through the work for the first time, and they're on amends, and I'll sit these people down, and we'll hear inventory together. So the person who's hearing their first fifth step is sitting there hearing a fifth step with somebody who's heard their 37,000, you know, fifth step, and they're listening to it, and they're going, you do that too? In the middle of the fifth step. And it's awesome. I'm not going to share this real quick. I did, at about 7 years sober, I did this multiple fist up. I had written like this like massive magnum opus of an inventory because like I was trying to write myself into like, you know, some sort of sainthood. You ever do that too? You ever write inventory so much that you're like trying to write yourself into like, you know, the Franciscan, you know. Yeah. I'm going to start like, you know, wearing a hair shirt and walking around with a golden bowl. You know, like somehow, like if I write the perfect inventory, I'll get like that magic thing and I'll stop being a jerk. That doesn't work, by the way. You know, a good friend of mine used to say, stop trying to hump your character defects into submission through inventory. So anyway, so I wrote this magnum opus of an inventory, right, where I thought that I was going to find that magic thing that was going to fix me so I would stop being a jerk. That's called lack of humility, by the way. You know, so I wrote this inventory, and I brought it, and I was like, so who do I fist step it with? And the suggestion was given to me to pick four of my sponsees who had been through and were on 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12 and have them listen to it. But the instruction was that they needed to have less than 2 years. So I get these girls together, four of them. We get together at a diner, and I start reading my inventory to them. And, of course, they're, like, primed because, like, I had been torturing them now for, like, 2 years, right? I had been, like, sitting there, like, with their nightly review and their 10 steps, and I had heard their inventories. I had heard their fist steps. So, like, I had, like, ripped these women, like, you know, like what we do, a little bit to shreds, just a tiny bit, right? You know, in that loving sponsorship way we do. Like, we ask them questions like, you know, where's God in that, you know? That way, that sponsorship question where you're like just looking at them and say, so where's God in that? And then they stare at you blankly and go, yeah, I guess I better go pray. You know, so I had been doing this to these women for like, you know, 2 years. And so they're sitting there, so they're like excited, man. I guess they like, you know, my self-centeredness said that they like sat around in the parking lot like 10 minutes before I showed up and like plotted what they were going to do to me. Like, they had been taking a list of all my character defects and all the things that they've seen me do that they didn't get a chance to call me on. Right? So they were like, they had, like, sharpened their knives. And so I did this fist step. And the whole time, right, I just wanted to say, when you're 7 years sober, you're going to be this fucked up too! But I did this fist step. And they tore into me. And I just sat there. And, of course, you know, you have to sit there and you say, is it true? Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yep. Oh, shit. I didn't see that. Oh, fuck, man. I'm really not well. So I had this experience. The diner that I did this at was like about 45 minutes from my house. So I'm driving home. It's 3:00 in the morning. I'm like punch drunk, crazy, caffeinated, and twitching. I come home and I'm like, how am I going to take like my quiet hour? Like, I'm like freaking psychotic in the corner, right? So I get really quiet, and I light all these candles, and I just pray, and I'm like, God, I just, you know, I need to take this quiet hour, I need to do this, and I sit down, because the only time the book ever tells us to stop working is during this quiet hour in which we go over our inventory, we think about our fifth step, we ask ourselves about the steps that we've done previously, we go into this place where we get, you know, because the fifth step isn't always about your sponsor, it's about God. And we leave that out sometimes. When we're doing the fist step, it's, you know, because that person's sitting there in front of us and they're the one who's talking to us, the person who's hearing our inventory, that's the dynamic, and we're leaving God out of it sometimes. Because I'm more focused on that interaction than I am with this broad spiritual principle of this step. You know, so it was suggested to me to read my inventory aloud to God after I do a fist step. So I'm doing this. And I'm taking my quiet hour, and I have this profound spiritual experience where I just put pen to paper. And I start writing. And I'm writing. And I'm writing. And all of a sudden, just this stuff is pouring out of me. And I have this white light spiritual experience where, like, my life, there are a couple points in my life, giving birth to my 4 children being one of them, getting married being another, putting down alcohol on September 6th, 1994, and this moment where I was a different person. I had this moment. Something happened. I cannot describe it. I do not know. But I have never been the same Carrie again. And that experience carried me for so many years. I mean, it was an incredible thing. And I cannot tell you what happened. I just know that something opened up. I'm 7 years sober. I've been doing inventory for years. I've been sponsoring for years. I'm doing big book workshops. I'm doing all of these things. And I have this profound white light spiritual experience. They happen. I've been waiting for it for years. And when I stopped asking God for it, it happened. So the fifth step is an incredibly crucial thing. It is about seeing the truth. It is about looking at yourself. It is about not liking what you see, because if you like what you see, you will continue to think that you were God. It's about recognizing where I end and God begins. It's about defining those boundaries. And what I mean by the I mean the concept of the mind, not I as a spiritual being. There is an I that is a spiritual being that is an infinite part of God. And then there is the I that is attached to the ego that believes that it is God and creates reality in its own perspective. And what I need to do is recognize when the ego I is dictating reality. When I'm arguing with reality, I have anxiety. Anxiety is simply arguing with what is. There is no point to it. It is. When I'm run by fear, I'm arguing with reality. So for me, it's about seeing these things. And then, of course, you know, that looking at my conduct and looking at how these fears, these beliefs, these concepts have impacted other people. Because I only look at how things affect me and how I feel because I'm selfish and self-centered. When I stop to look at the ripple effect that happens when I take a specific certain action and how that affects those around me, how I rob the security, how I rob the safety of other people, how my tongue can lash people, how I play God, how my belief systems, I impose them on other people, and I say that I'm helping you when I'm really trying to control you. You ever do that? So this is all part of this process, and it's a deeper surrender. We surrender with alcohol, and then we surrender with our spirit. And that surrender with our spirit occurs in the fourth and the fifth step. Because I begin to understand the idea that my ideas do not work and the God idea does. And I see in black and white, and I'll finish this up. I'm a believer in the book. I'm a fundamentalist. I am such a fundamentalist big book thumper, it is pathetic. So I know I'm preaching to the choir with that. So here's the thing. Pen to paper. Pen to paper. Inventory does not occur in our head. When you tell me you thought about your fourth column, I tell you you thought about bullshit. You're in your second column. Because clarity and freedom occurs when I put pen to paper. I'm also one of those people, and I believe in aversion therapy. Write it out. Don't type it up. I type all day long. I could type for hours. Write I'm a selfish, self-centered asshole 37 times till my hand wants to fall off. Guess what? You'll stop doing it. It's this amazing thing. You ever write a four-step to your hand cramps? I'm in the middle of writing inventory, by the way. I have an indent in my middle finger. I'm not giving you guys a bird. I'm saying seriously. I write into my hand cramps. Write I'm selfish and self-centered by hand in your fourth column until your hand cramps. And guess what? It's this amazing thing. That experience of writing that over and over again and feeling the physical discomfort and feeling the ickiness of writing that and feeling how you feel, thinking about what you did, feeling all that shit, it really helps that whole letting go of these ideas. It is part of that process. So I'm an old-fashioned gal. I like a notebook and a pen. I've actually given direction to sponsees who have, like, you know, they're like their first four-step. They're like, I'm going to write it in Excel. And I said, well, then you're going to get another sponsor. I want you to write this out. I want you to feel the discomfort of it. Because if I don't feel uncomfortable, I'm never, 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 never going to let go of these things. I need to learn how to be uncomfortable with God. I need to face pain. Alcoholics have a fear of pain. We have a fear of discomfort. We have that magical thinking, if I take a pill, if I put something in my body, I can change how I feel and I'll be okay. I do that very same thing in recovery. I want to avoid feeling uncomfortable. I want to avoid looking bad. I want to avoid being humbled. This is a humbling process. I need to be humbled. Being humble is not about being humiliated. Being humbled is about being right-sized in God's universe. There's nothing wrong with humility. Nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's a spiritual virtue of this program. And part of experiencing humility is experiencing the discomfort of not liking who you are and seeking being a child of God. And not that we don't know that we're not a child of God, but we're not aware of the fact that we're a child of God. I needed to experience being a child of God in this universe. I was a child of my own creation because I worshiped my mind like it was a higher power. When I experienced the discomfort of seeing the wreckage of what happens when Carrie worshiped her mind, I began to experience what it meant to be a child of God, because I realized that my thoughts were like weather, my emotions were like weather, they go through me. I do not need to pay attention to what I think because it's usually bullshit. I don't need to pay attention to my emotions because they're sickened. My instincts are something different. There's something called that sixth sense that happens when we've had this process, when this wreckage has been cleared, when the conduit between me and God, that experience of being a child of God, that knowing that I am a child of God occurs. We begin to have this vital sixth sense and we'll know things. I have a sponsee. Well, actually, she's drinking right now, so I don't know what she is. She's a friend. But she would text me. She was like, she's been in and out for the past couple months. And she'll text me like, I drank last night. And I'm like, I know. I'm like, how do you know? I knew from your text 2 days ago that you were going to drink. Well, how'd you know that? God told me. I was like, what do you want to do about it? You ready to stop? No. Okay. And then she'll text me, I did heroin last week. Really? I'm not surprised. How'd you know? God told me. I know when she's using. I just know. Like, I'll be just sitting in morning meditation and be like, yeah, she's high again. God tells me. And it'll be the funniest thing, because I'll tell my husband. I'll be like, yeah, I think so-and-so's high. And then, like, through one of his sponsees, he'll be like, yeah, she totally is. How'd you know that? God told me. It's this amazing thing. When we're awake, we see things. Because I'm not clouded by my own judgments. I'm not clouded by my own mind. I'm not clouded by worshiping my mind and my thoughts. That I can see you more clearly. When I can see you more clearly, I see myself more clearly. Because we're spiritual mirrors of one another. That's also another benefit of the fifth step practice is about being a mirror for one another. The light of God is reflected back. We reflect together. But also our character defects, our humanness. And it's a beautiful thing to experience that humanness with another person and have them experience their humanness and for us to be laughing about the silly, idiotic things that we do. We experience joy in the midst of feeling this complete and utter brokenness of the way that I'm seeing things and the way that I'm doing things, the ways I'm going about things, I'm experiencing a complete and utter brokenness. I totally know that my map is completely kablooey, right? My map for navigating the world is kablooey, right? And I totally know this. I'm experiencing the hopelessness of the way that I'm approaching things. In the meantime, I'm laughing my ass off and experiencing incredible joy and freedom in having other people experience this with me. They're experiencing it. I'm experiencing it. We're experiencing it because we know that there's a God that can take care of this problem. When I'm worshiping my mind is the problem, man. So when I experience my map being broken, my map being accurate, my GPS is off kilter and I'm navigating my life based on false assumptions, right? When I experience the hopelessness of this, it's not such a bad thing. When I'm butting my head up against the wall and I keep saying, why do I have a headache? Why do I have a headache? Stop hitting myself in the head with a fucking hammer. That's why you have a fucking headache. When I figure out that what I'm doing is not working, I could stop doing it because I can go to the very thing that's going to stop me, which is God. So when I tell you that it's okay to feel like shit about what you're doing, it's okay to look at your four step and be like, I'm an ass. Good. Because there's a solution to being an ass. Because there is a power greater than ourselves that can rescue us from our mind. There's a power greater than ourselves that can make your emotions not dictate your reality. My sponsor used to tell me all the time, my feelings are not fact. Feelings are not fact. I'm like, fuck you. I feel like shit. Your feelings are not fact, Carrie. It's the truth. I can feel however I want. It does not change reality, not one bit. My feelings are weather. They go through me and in me. They process. I stop fighting them. Because fighting my feelings, fighting reality, fighting my thoughts, they do not work. I cannot combat my thoughts. I cannot combat my emotions. The only thing I can do is surrender to them and accept that God is going to do with them as he will. And that's all part of what happens in the fifth step process. There's a lot of things going on. You're not just reading words on a page, man. It's an incredibly dynamic spiritual experience that evolves every time you go back to it. We got another like 20 minutes, I think.
So I'm going to read. I'm going to read a paragraph that talks about maybe what our experience can be after we've done a fifth step. The instruction basically is we pocket. Somebody told me I should talk about what page I'm on when I'm reading. So I'm gonna start doing that. That's some good constructive criticism. This is page 75. Two paragraphs down. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And that's one of the instructions for doing the fifth step. Then it says, once we have taken the step withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And that's an incredible promise right there. when I was drinking, you know, talk about insanity. It's crazy. I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw the steps on the wall, and I saw step two, and I was like, you know, I was like insulted. You're assuming that I'm insane. You know, I take exception to that. But picture this. This is typical. This is as soon as I got home, as soon as I poured a drink and went up into my room, what I would do is I would turn on the TV. I'd be playing the stereo. I would have a guitar in my lap, I'd be practicing scales, and I would be reading a magazine. And, you know, probably talking on the phone too soon. Like, think about that. Think about how much I needed to be away from me. Just think about that, you know. To be alone at perfect peace and ease was an incredible promise for me. Mm-hmm. To be alone at perfect peace and ease. That's impossible. I had to be in a blackout to be at perfect peace and ease. So that's an incredible promise, specifically for me. Our fears fall from us, which means we're going to be more comfortable in our own skin. We're going to be comfortable with ourselves and with our environment. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator, and that's a great one. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And these are some of the fifth step promises. Now, there's some warnings in the fourth step. There's some warnings in the fifth step, especially a number of warnings in the fifth step, which basically say if you skimp this step, you'll probably pay for it by a spree. Now, I go to a lot of beginners meetings. I go to places where there are a lot of newcomers. It's just something that I do. Not every meeting I go to is a beginners meeting because I'd want to kill myself if that was true. But I need to go there because that's where the people that really need help are going to show up usually at the discussion meetings or at the beginners groups. And forever people are raising their hand and saying they're coming back. And a lot of times they've been coming to the beginner's meeting for a while, and they relapse, and they come back, and they're like shocked. They get like a look of surprise on their face. They're like, oh, I relapsed. And they just can't believe it. And the fact of the matter is, you know, ask them some questions. You know, did you do a fifth step? Well, no, not yet. And the fact of the matter is you are supposed to drink. If you don't do a fifth step, don't be surprised if you get drunk and you haven't done a fifth step. This book warns you six different times that you're probably going to get drunk if you don't do a fifth step. So let's not be surprised anymore, folks, if somebody gets drunk and they haven't done a fifth step, because we're not supposed to be surprised. So often what we do is we buffer our message because we're afraid somebody's not going to like us. So we'll buffer our message. We'll basically say, look, just keep coming, you know. It'll get you. You know, you'll get the miracle. Here's my phone number. Give me a call. I think it's more important. Listen, I was upset with people that looked me right in the eye and told me the truth. I got very pissed off with them. But they helped me more than the people that patted me on the head and told me I was doing great. Oh, Chris, you're doing great. You know, see you at all the meetings, you know, and you're sharing and, you know, you're making coffee, you're great, you know, and pat me on the head. No, I needed the person that looked at me. I remember I was in outpatient and I shared, you know, they were talking about how everybody's experience with getting a sponsor. And I shared for like the sixth week in a row, I'm still shopping around. I want to find the right guy. And this guy looked me right in the eye and said this. He goes, if I was 5 weeks sober and I was still looking for a sponsor, I'd have been drunk. You know, I needed a sponsor right away. And what he did was he shamed me because he just told me that, you know, the way that I was going wasn't the right way to do it. So I had a real resentment. But I had to internalize, you know, I had to come to terms with what this guy said. And you know what? After I came back, you know, because I did get drunk, after I came back, I realized that I needed to get a sponsor. And I got one on my second night. My second night back, I got a sponsor. And I held on to him, for a long time. And I was paying a lot of attention to what he was sharing. You know, so much of this is preparing ourselves, moving things aside, but preparing ourselves to experience the power of God in our lives. It just is. Me on my own out there, I can't tell you the amount of mistakes that I made. I really need to have some guidance. I need to have human guidance. That's a sponsor. And, you know, sometimes the group's wisdom is awful good. But the real guidance that I need is a spiritual guidance. And these steps are basically preparing me to get access to that spiritual guidance. Now, all right, we've done the fifth step. There's a returning home piece in here that I would suggest that no one miss. You know, after you've done, shared your fifth step, the last part of that step is returning home and looking at the first five steps. Have you skimped on the cement? Have you half measured anything? Because it's so important that you're thorough, that you're fearless and you're thorough through the first five steps. And I think the returning home part is giving you an opportunity to figure out if you have skimped on anything, that you can fix that. You know, it's going to give you an opportunity to fix it. When I hear fifth steps, I always direct somebody to go home, do the quiet hour, and here is my cell phone, and I will be available. I will be available. Or I send them to a church or somewhere where they're going to be undisturbed. I will be available. If there's anything that you forgot to share with me, if there's any other direction that you need, please give me a call. And then we need to start looking at steps 6 and step 7. Steps 6 and step 7 are two paragraphs. And because they're two paragraphs, sometimes we can miss the enormity of these steps. These are enormous steps. I believe that, you know, it says in the step book, the 12 steps and 12 traditions, that these are the steps, or this is the step that separate the men from the boys. You know, I understand how important they are in my life today. I think in step 4, we recognize what's blocking us off from a true spiritual connection. In step 5, we share all that. In step 6... we become willing to have God remove these defects of character that we've identified in step 4 and we've shared in step 5. Now, you know, there's been some very influential people who've done workshops in the past, and you're always going to hear somebody that sounds very authoritative in meetings that talk about how we have to, you know, we have to do this, we have to take responsibility, and we have to do this. Here's the truth as I experienced it. These character defects were bigger than me. If I could have done a better job, I probably would have. Now, our ego wants to take ownership of these character defects, and now that we've identified them, we can do a better job in the future. That can be a dead end, folks. That can I'm not saying there's not some things we can change. I'm not saying that, you know, if robbery isn't part of our is part of our fifth step, that we can't stop robbing. But a lot of these character defects are under the horizon. A lot of these character defects are endemic. The fabric of our existence is shot through with these character defects. And a lot of times, most of the time, they're bigger than what we can handle on our own. We need to have spiritual help. I mean, think about drinking. I tried to quit drinking for at least 4 years before I was able to. And I was only able to with massive amounts of outside help. I wanted to separate from alcohol. Listen, here was my experience. This is any day in my last 4 years. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes that I had passed out in the night before. Sometimes I'd come to on the floor. What I would be doing is I would be drinking a gigantic glass of bourbon, and I would pass out in the chair, and I would slam down onto the floor. And I didn't even know enough to put carpet down. I mean, literally, I'd pass out in my chair every single night for 4 years onto a wooden floor. I was just too busy to go get carpet. But I would come to in the morning. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes, stinking of alcohol, stinking of bourbon, or stinking of vodka. It would just be coming out of my pores. And I would struggle into the bathroom and, you know, throw some water on my face and brush my teeth and do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, because I smoked and I drank. And when you do that, you have the morning vomiting calisthenics, okay? Yeah, you know, then I'd struggle out to my $100 car, you know, that had like, you know, wasn't inspected, and, you know, needed like, it was a $100 car that needed $2,000 worth of work, you know, just typical Alka car. And I would drive to, I'd be driving to work, you know, and if I would have gotten pulled over, I hadn't had a drink since 7 o'clock the night before, but if I would have gotten pulled over, I would have blown a breathalyzer and it would have been a 0.28 or something. You know, that was my normal, you know, existence. I was somewhere around 2.8 because I was always, you know, I was always like a quart low. And so I'd get to, you know, I'd be driving to work and I'd be swearing to God I'm never going to drink again. Never, ever. This is the day. Today is the day. I know I've said this before, but today is the day that I am going to stop drinking. I don't want to feel like this anymore. Really, alcoholics don't have hangovers. I found this out through some of my studies with the professionals. Alcoholics don't have hangovers. They're feeling the effects of alcohol poisoning. If you drink a quart of booze, you are poisoning yourself with ethyl alcohol. That's not a hangover. You're poisoning yourself. So I'm driving into work poisoned, saying, I am never going to do this again. That is a very sane statement. I'm not going to poison myself anymore makes a lot of sense to a normal person. And I mean it. And I'm saying today is the day. And if you would have hooked me up to a lie detector, the polygraph guy would have said, you know, are you quitting drinking for good and for all today? Yes. The needle would have gone right to he's telling the truth because I mean it. I don't want to feel this bad anymore. Now, here's what would happen. I'd be at work and, you know, lunchtime had come and I'd get about a half a gallon of liquid down because, you know, you got to rehydrate. You know, somebody'd go out for food and I'd get like half a sandwich down. It'd be like 3 o'clock, you know, I'd get off at 4 and I'd start to think to myself, you know that position you took, you know, this morning on never ever drinking again, you know, that's kind of an overreaction. That's a really strong position to take. Never, ever drink again, ever. Now, by 4 o'clock, I'm telling myself that I need to modify that decision. That decision needs modification. As a matter of fact, when I leave, I need to go to the liquor store, and I need to get some vodka to have a drink because you know, I just today was just a hard day. I need a little alcohol. So right to the liquor store, right home, starting to drink another quart of booze. Now listen, in the morning, it was the same thought to never, ever drink again. That was rational and that was sane. Halfway through the day, the insanity, the obsession of the mind was coming on me, and that was flat out insanity, and it was bigger than me, and there was nothing I could do. I didn't have power, choice, and control. You would have looked at me and you would have said, this guy is crazy after being as sick as he was this morning to go back to the liquor store, but I didn't have any control. I was not responsible for this. It's insanity. And it's the insanity of alcoholism. I had no mental defense against going to the liquor store after work that day. I didn't have access to the sound, sane decision I made earlier in the morning. That insane, the strange mental blank spot, the subtle form of insanity that precedes the first drink or the first drug was on me. And when it came time to separate from alcohol, I needed the power of God to be able to get through that, for that decision to work. Now, when I'm looking at the character defects in the 12 and 12, it asks us to look at these character defects the same way we looked at the need for God with alcohol. We're supposed to look for the need for God to overcome these character defects in the same way. As a drowning man seizes a life preserver, that's how we need to access God for the removal of these character defects. We need to become willing to have God remove these defects of character like a defeated person. You know, we've been defeated by these character defects. These character defects are what's causing our alcoholism and our failure at life. Our life is a piece of crap because of these character defects. And if we could change and do a better job, we would have by now. We need some help. So when we move into step 6, we need to move into it with that type of humility, with the type of humility brought on by desperate attempts to do better that have not worked. We have been defeated. We have been overwhelmed with these character defects, and we need God's help. And in step 7, we need to humbly, from a perspective of defeat, we need to ask God to help us with these defects of character. And that this is an enormous process. We can read those two paragraphs and we can think, oh, I'll just do the prayer. Oh, God, you know, relieve me of this. That ain't it, folks. I mean, you know, this is something that has to come from our soul. We need to truly understand that these character defects are what is causing our failure at life, and we need to have God's help. And when we make the demonstration of the 7-step prayer, we need to understand that it's a desperate situation. I like to tell this story. In World War II, Japan decides to enter the war, and they decide to do it by bombing Pearl Harbor. Now, America really isn't set up for a world war at this period of time, right? But we understand that we need to respond to this, and we need to be serious about the response. So what we do is we turn all our car manufacturing plants and everything into a war machine. And anybody that was alive during World War II knows that everybody was involved in this effort. You would save your gum wrapper, you know, and send it to the recycler so it could be turned into a bullet. I mean, everybody was about this business. And what happened was we got involved in the war. We kicked some real ass. And we went over there and we've developed new technology, and we developed what was to be known as the atom bomb. Now, we were already bombing Japan, you know, but we dropped an atom bomb on Nagasaki, and we dropped one on Hiroshima, and they said, whoa, holy mackerel, okay, stop fighting, we surrender. And Douglas MacArthur came in and said, we will accept your surrender under one condition. Well, what is that? Unconditional surrender, okay? You surrender, you stop fighting, you put all your arms down. We're going to come in there and we're going to tell you what this surrender is about. And that's what happened. And from this surrender, Japan paid very close attention to the conditions. They met those conditions and more. Japan has become an unbelievable industrial powerhouse. And listen, what do you think would have happened to them if they would have said, well, you know, condition one and two are okay, but I'm not really sure if condition three is going to work for us. That's inconvenient. What would have happened in the middle of the surrender if they decided that, well, you know, you told us to put down our arms, but we're going to rearm because that works better for us. What do you think would have happened? You know, we would have come back in and we would have pummeled them even more. When we're looking at steps 6 and 7, we need to look at it with this type of surrender. This is an unconditional surrender. These need to be our conditions. Our conditions of surrender. We need to pay attention to this stuff because our life has been atom bombed. You know, we have been clobbered. You know, we're getting out of the trenches from the front lines of the battlefield, usually when we show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we need to put down our arms. And you know what our arms are? You know, our ego and, you know, what we want to do and what we think about things and our prejudices. We need to put all that stuff down and we need to surrender. And in step 6 and step 7, we're doing that with our character defects. And you know what the conditions of the removal of your character defects are going to be? To become willing to make amends to the people in the institutions whom those character defects have harmed, and actually make direct amends to those institutions and those principles that have been harmed by our character defects. That's how surrendered we have to be for the removal of these character defects. You cannot just wish them away. Mm-hmm. You have to take serious, serious action for these character defects to go away because they are ingrained. They're ingrained into you in such a deep level that you have no idea. I'm going to tell one story, and then I'm going to turn it back over to Carrie. We've got a few minutes left. All right, I'm sponsoring this guy. He's one of those New Jersey guys that know people. You know what I mean? And he's a tough guy. He's got a big, huge business. But he's got a real sense of the street about him. But alcoholism and drug addiction blew him up. So, I mean, he was rendered mute like the first year he was in AA. He was like, whoa. I mean, his life had been blown up. So he had a sense of urgency about this stuff. He did not want to die. So he became willing to go to any lengths. And I ended up being his sponsor. And we're all, you know, we ride together to this meeting this one time, and we stop at the 7-Eleven to get a cup of coffee. And we're walking out, and as we're both walking out, he does this. Whoosh, grabs a pack of cigarettes, puts it in his pocket. And I'm like, I do like a double take, and we're out on the sidewalk. And I'm like, wait a minute, hey. He's like, whoa. I go, hey, you took that pack of cigarettes. You didn't pay for it. He's like, what? I'm like, you took that pack of cigarettes. You stole a pack of cigarettes. He goes, no. I go, I saw you do it. You know, I saw you take the pack of cigarettes on the way out. You stole a pack of cigarettes. He goes, no, that was from the display in the front. I'm like, what does that have to do with it? He goes, they expect you to steal stuff off the thing in the front. They got budgets for that. I was taught you're a chump if you don't take anything from them. I'm like, hold on. No, you stole a pack of cigarettes, you know? We're going to have a sponsor summit right here and right now, okay? Now, I got him to look at it from a different perspective, you know? And finally he got it. And he's like, oh. So here's what he did. He was willing to go to any lengths, so what we did is we put an 8-step list together. He put envelopes together of an amount of money that he believed he stole for like 20 of these 7-Elevens. And you know what he did? He went around to every single 7-Eleven and he met with the manager and he handed him the money, and he made the mumbled, you know, best he could explanation of what he was trying to do. And he did this. He did this with 20 different 7-Elevens. Let me ask you guys a question right here and right now. You think he still steals cigarettes from 7-Elevens? I don't think so. There's a power in 8 and 9 that are directly related back to 6 and 7. So when we're willing to make, when we're willing to go to any lengths, we need to go to the whole length, you know, this whole series of steps.
Very cool. Yeah, I don't have all that much to say on it because I think Chris covered it in masterly detail in terms of 6 and 7. And, of course, 8 and 9. And, of course, I go a little further and say 10 and 11, you know, because, like, you know, it's that whole thing. It's like, you know, going and making amends and knocking on the door is great, but maintaining a spiritual way of life that prevents me from ever returning to those behaviors. So 8, 9, 10, and 11. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, and really, really, really quickly, my sponsor had me, in terms of 6 and 7, to meditate on the concept of my creator. If you read the third step prayer, it says, we say to our maker. And in the seventh step prayer, it says, my creator. So it was one of those things or one of those concepts or ideas in terms of 6 and 7 to realize that, you know, I am none of my business. I don't get to decide what I keep. I don't get to decide what my character looks like. Because when I made those decisions, I did a very bad job of it. So that unconditional surrender that Chris was talking about in terms of what my spiritual life looks like, what my life looks like, who Carrie becomes. I would have beat the shit out of me on the street if I was drinking. I would have robbed me, actually. Now, actually, I don't have anything good to rob anymore, but you know, I definitely would have, like, tried. I never wanted to be, like, the soccer mom with four kids. Like, I didn't want to be a shrink. Like, I played with skulls and stuff, you know? Like, I wanted to be cool. You know, like, I don't want to be this person. God decided that this is what Carrie was going to be. Like, I wanted to, like, you know, I came into AA and I had, like, a green mohawk. I carried knives. I was covered in tattoos. I wore Doc Martens. I still have Doc Martens, by the way. But, you know, like, I was, like, you know, a little punk street rat. Like, the last thing I thought I was going to become was an upstanding member of society. Like, that really wasn't on my action item list in terms of, you know, what I was going to get out of life. You know, but when I did this step process, when I surrendered, when I made that unconditional surrender, and when I surrendered to the concept of my creator, that I wasn't creating myself, that there was something greater that created me, that I had a maker, that there was a creation that was going on around me, and when my ego is engaged in creating my reality, I'm not participating in God's creation because I'm being God. I'm going to say this again. Think about this for a minute because it was really profound and I did not make this up. I am not that smart. It's been taught to me. When my ego is busy engaged in creating my reality, I can't participate in the creator's creation because I'm busy creating my own reality. There's that question in the Nightly Review when it talks about trying to pack things into the stream of life, right? That's a pretty interesting question when you think about it because it comes right back to this concept of am I participating in God's creation or am I creating the world in my likeness and image? So when I think about things in terms of the 6 and 7 step, I think about things in terms of my creator. I am not my creator. My mind is not my creator. My mind did not create you. My mind did not create me. My mind does not dictate reality. My mind does not dictate your reality. My thoughts are not the alpha and the omega, that there is something greater than what occurs in my cranium, and that what happens to me, what happens in my spiritual life, and I love that because that's one of those things, my spiritual life is me, but what happens within me has absolutely nothing to do with me and is none of my business, because when I meddle with it, I fuck it up. Say that again. When I meddle with my spiritual growth, I fuck it up. So when we say my creator, it means I stop trying to create myself and I allow God to do with me what he chooses to do. The outcome of that is none of my business. I think we could take a break now for lunch. Thanks.